Aloha and welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. This conversation can include you. If you'd like to join us, our number is 941-3689. And just a reminder, you're listening to a rebroadcast of Town Square, and calls will not be taken at the number given. This week, a Honolulu City Council committee approved a bill to expand the sit-lie ordinance. If the entire council agrees, sit-lie could soon come to parts of Iwilei and Kalihi. Since the Waikiki pilot of the first sit-lie ordinance in late 2014, opponents have said that the measure criminalizes homeless people and tries to force them into shelters that many of them say make them feel less safe than the places they choose on the street. Almost 2 years ago, a UH study found the sit-lie ban and the accompanying police sweeps to be ineffective in streaming houseless people toward official help. Now, whether that study was too early in the life of the ban, well, the criticism still persists, aided by similar situations in other municipalities grappling with sit-lie. Today on Town Square, we'll look at a Honolulu City Council bill, Bill 13, and we'll see it from differing perspectives, a Kalihi business, a social services provider, and the ACLU. Joining me around the table, Neil Arakaki is here. He's president of Menehunumak. That's the brand name of the Hawaiian Candies and Nuts Company, founded in 1939, and it's been owned for the past 30 years as a family-run business in Kalihi. Connie Mitchell joins us. She's the executive director of IHS, the Institute for Human Services. IHS is Hawaii's oldest, largest, and most comprehensive human services agency, exclusively devoted to ending and preventing homelessness. And to round out our panel, Mateo Caballero is here. He's the legal director of the ACLU of Hawaii. The ACLU locally and in other jurisdictions continue to challenge the constitutionality of sit-lie bans. And again, you're here too. But just a reminder, this is a rebroadcast of today's Town Square, and so phone calls will not be taken at the number given. Welcome to all of you. Thank you for being here.
Aloha, Beth Ann.
Aloha. People see homelessness through their own lens, whatever it is that they experience continually, and that may not necessarily be the fullness of the expression of homelessness that you may see when you step out your door or deal with the people that come to you for help. I'd like to go around the table and get a snapshot of what it is that you see, and maybe that way that will help us to understand a little bit better what it is that you're each seeing as you regard not only sit-lie, but what you have happening in your own neighborhoods. Mateo, I'll start with you.
Sure. So I would like to say, you know, we all live in the same city, so we all have to live with homelessness, and we have seen it increase over the years. And we all agree, I hope, that, you know, we all have equal rights, we all have equal access to public spaces, and that homelessness can happen to anyone. In fact, almost 50% of folks in Hawaii live paycheck to paycheck. So, of course, you know, homelessness is a delicate topic because it's a marginalized community, it's very vulnerable, there's a lot of stigma associated with being homeless. And so, you know, what we would like is that, again, and I hope there's agreement, that we want policies and programs that should improve the lives of the homeless, make sure that they can get out of it, not make their lives worse. And we want, of course, all we want a city that is clean, healthy, and diverse, and that is welcoming to everyone. So the question is, you know, how do we do that? And I think from the perspective of the ACLU, we see a fork in the road. On the one hand, we see criminalization and what, you know, has been going on in the past few years here. And on the other hand, we see, you know, a harm reduction model. And I can say that, you know, and based on the statistics, what we have seen is just an increase in unsheltered homeless in Oahu, even as we have had sit-lie and a number of other ordinances. Because this is not just about sit-lie. This is about a whole host of ordinances and regulations that make it much more difficult to be homeless.
Connie Mitchell.
Well, from my perspective as a service provider that sees a whole spectrum of homeless people, from the people who are unsheltered that our outreach teams deal with, all the way to people who are experiencing crises, housing crises that really need a lift to get into another housing situation, we acknowledge a lot of the things that Mateo mentioned about how unsheltered homelessness has been growing. The fact is that it's shifted, and we believe that more people are unsheltered largely because it's more permissible in some ways because of some of the things that have happened over time. But we clearly see that there are definitely the vulnerability and the stigma attached to homelessness that need to be acknowledged and we need to have compassion for. But I think from my perspective, there's also people who are not necessarily being criminalized. They are actually actively doing criminal activity that need to be stopped as well.
Which is another part of the homelessness equation that we don't necessarily talk about that much. But I would imagine in some ways, Neil, you see some of that activity outside your business.
This is one of the concerns that has been growing over the years as the homeless community has grown. And we do have a rather chronic encampment on the side of my buildings. It seems to me that there is an element, and I have to preface this saying that we actually agree a lot with what's going on out there. This is a really difficult situation, and it's a hard call. But we are dealing with an immediate problem. We have immediate criminal activity. We have immediate property damage. We have immediate, for lack of a better word, threats to personal safety on a daily basis, right now in our face, associated with these encampments. And we know not every person in the encampment is a criminal, but there are embedded parts of this sheltering, this encampment that are chronic and they're predatory. And we are not able to address it. The current laws don't allow us to stop these people. We have to catch them in the act. So if you're not there literally 24 hours a day to physically watch them, they can get away with a lot of things. We've had property damage, almost on a daily basis, just within a four-building area of my place.
Yeah. Can you be a little more specific about some of the threats, some of the property damage, some of the things that you say that you face every single day?
Well, a lot of it is, well, we have the minor violations, people throwing trash and those kind of things. During the sweep days, we have huge amounts of people's personal belongings being packed up because they're cleaning the streets, and they'll throw it onto the personal properties. And I mean pallet side loads of going into the middle of your parking lots. And we are not sure if we can move this. We're not sure if we can. We don't have any parking at all in these areas. We've had physical assaults. We've had physical assaults on our property. Luckily not with my employees, but there were people physically assaulted. The police were called. I've had property damage to the building in thousands of dollars. It looked like somebody took a sledgehammer or a metal pipe and just took out one of my support columns. Maybe or maybe not related to the fact that we actually called the police on a trespass the day before.
And do you have any cameras around the buildings to be able to see this? You made the point that, you know, if you can't catch somebody, how do you know?
Yeah, we have a I don't have any cameras per se. And I'll tell you what's happened. I'm the very corner building onto White Camilo Road, and the encampment is visible from White Camilo. Over the last 2 or 3 years, as this encampment is growing, it's been affecting my business. People are afraid to come to my property. And I transitioned my factory. We're a retail-based operation. We're not a wholesale-based operation. I need people to physically come in and purchase product. And we try to do a good job. When people are physically afraid to come in, your traffic will drop. Your sales will drop. This, you don't have a financial base to make these improvements. We've had estimates to install cameras, $12,000, $15,000 to do an adequate camera installation. That means I would have to fire 2 employees to cover the cost in 1 month. It's really that simple. We don't have the economic means to address, and we do have other businesses in the area with full camera support, and they've been able to do that, and they have been able to use their camera footage to any effective degree because you can catch the act on camera doesn't mean you can stop the act from being, and you can't go down and apprehend the person. It's very difficult. Yeah,
Mateo, I mean, you've heard this from other businesses too, and clearly understand that they're saying, "Hey, we're compassionate, but is anybody going to be compassionate toward us?" How do you begin to balance different types of compassion and allow different types of homelessness to proliferate and others to be able to be moved into some real help. How do you answer when you hear someone talk as Neil is talking now?
Of course. And the ACLU does not condone, you know, property damage, vandalism, any of that. So the question is, what is the most appropriate response to what's going on and to the growing homelessness? And I'll say this. What you have seen and the increase in places like Kalihi, where in the past few years you have seen a lot of more homeless move there, is actually a direct result of Sitlai. Because what happened is that as Sitlai expanded to other areas of the city, they have migrated. And they have migrated where there is to areas where there is no Sitlai. And that's why they end up in, you know, a new business's doorsteps. So what we can expect is, quite honestly, is as we continue to expand Sitlai, they will just move to different areas of the city. And it might not be, a particular business's doorsteps, but it will be a different one. So what I'm trying to say is that, you know, yes, I think this is a problem. And then the question is, what is the best solution? And I don't think Sitlai or criminalization is the solution because, as I said, what we have seen in the past few years is an increase in the unsheltered homeless, not a decrease, even though we have had Sitlai now for a couple of years.
Connie, jump in with all of this, too, because your organization was, I think, one of the only in the social services provider group which was in favor of Sitlai with the original pilot. Now, as we've had some experience with it, clearly seeing that unsheltered population has grown, you're making a real distinction between what or how we look at homelessness in subpopulations. How do you go about trying to deal with perhaps growing Sitlai and more people who may simply shift elsewhere? What happens when there's nobody else
to
go?
I think I would like to challenge the statement that Mateo made because I don't believe that people have only just shifted. I think a lot of people have availed themselves of services, and part of that is because the police having the right to go up to say, hey, you don't belong here, you can't be sitting here, actually gives them the right to also offer some services and make referrals. So a lot of those times where people were given warnings, they were also given the opportunity to come into shelters, to go to the many shelters that have beds also. And so I think that, you know, there are people that we have tracked and some of them have migrated from one area to the other, but we also know that many people have availed themselves of services as well. So, you know, so I wanted to start with that at first. We also feel like we've been successful in Waikiki. When the Sitlai went into effect in Waikiki, we actually served quite a number of people, and in the last 2 years, we've served 839 people. 488 of them actually went into shelter or housing, and 282 of them were relocated, you know, back to the mainland where they had supports. You know, so it wasn't as if there was just a wholesale, you know, enforcement of Sitlai saying you have to get out of here and there's no place to go. But in fact, there were a lot of people that availed themselves of services as a result.
So with the growing population, though, how then do you retool to be able to handle some of that? And do we have any solid numbers now? I mean, obviously, we've had the point in time count that was done in January. We won't get those numbers for a little while yet. So everything we're looking is, you know, back over our shoulder. But in terms of actual numbers of people moving, have they done or have either of you been able to do a tracking of how many people shifted from one area to another? Is that part of the data set? Do we actually know where people are shifting to?
Well, we do track them in outreach just because we continue to want to offer services to people. And we recognize, you know, when people do come from one area or another. For instance, you know, when Waikiki Sitlai went into effect, you know, we knew that some people were leaving the area at a certain time. Some of them go back, but they were going to the Ala Moana and Kapahulu areas, you know, for a little bit. But as I mentioned before, it wasn't all of them. And many of them did come into shelter because we were providing a shuttle for them to actually experience, you know, what it would be like in the shelter. So, you know, I would say that there are a number of people that do avail themselves of services, especially after they've been out there and, you know, realize, oh, you know, somebody tells them, you know, in the intervention, you can go, you know, to a shelter and tells them where they can. So I think it's really a twofold thing. And we don't really support Sitlai as a homeless solution. It's really an opportunity to just direct people to more appropriate services.
We've got a couple of callers on the line, but just a reminder, this is a rebroadcast of today's Town Square, and so phone calls will not be taken at the number given. Going to Carl, calling us from Hilo. Aloha, Carl. Welcome to Town Square. Hi there.
I wanted to point out that if we criminalize the homeless lying down, we essentially are criminalizing the homeless sleeping. And what we need to be able to do is we need to be able to discourage homelessness, but at the same time, we need to be able to meaningfully address the real causes for people who are homeless who do not choose to be. Now, the bottom line is what people need mostly is they need to be made aware that they cannot camp out urbanly and do whatever for earning money. We have anti-loitering laws, which I believe would allow us to more effectively take people off the street. But then the moral question is, what do you do with them? The homeless need job training. They do not need only homes that they can't afford. They need jobs. I work in dog training. I have never met a homeless person who could not participate meaningfully in some aspect of dog work. For instance, doggy daycare, where the main job is play with the dogs all day. We can give these people jobs if we think creatively about it.
Okay, I mean, Carl, you're bringing up another point of that. Would there be things that could be streamed into? And certainly a lot of the programs that that help homeless people try to stream them into those kinds of jobs, something that they can do and not to have a great deal of training to be able to access. But, you know, the idea that there's only, you know, one homeless population, I mean, let's disabuse ourselves of that now, because we have lots of different types of people who are homeless, families who are on the edge and as Mateo said earlier, maybe one paycheck away from finding themselves in the street, other people who have real substance abuse issues, other people who are dealing with mental illness when you have sometimes, you know, comorbidity, lots of things are going on at the same time. You know, we have to not simplify this as much as sometimes we would like to be able to get our arms around a very, very thorny issue.
I think Carl has a good point, though, that employment is a role, has a role in the solutions for homelessness. But many of the people that are on the street are also vulnerable. They suffer from mental illness. They suffer from substance abuse issues that have impaired them. And so we really need to address some of those issues and provide treatment for people when they would like it. The problem is if they continually resist it, then what would you do? You know, and I think that we're of the mind that we continue to try to enhance motivation to change their lives and to offer pathways out of that.
Do we have any data that shows how many people are moved into businesses by businesses that have been offering themselves as help or support for people who are homeless? In other words, people who would get directly involved in it, maybe your business, Neil, or another business close by, to be able to not just, you know, say they're causing a problem, but also offer a pathway to something better.
Well, in my experience, and there are outreach type of organizations and who hire the homeless who will come to apply. The problem is they do not come to apply. And as a general statement, labor is a huge problem in this town. I mean, I know dozens of companies who have been trying to hire anybody to take on either starting level jobs or intermediate level jobs, and they can't find workers. The work is there. The work is there if people want to apply for it. And it's not a secret. And when your unemployment rate is this low, you're not going to get the cream of the crop. That's given. But there's just no takers. There's no takers for the open positions that we see from our industries.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to move on a little bit, going now to Daniel calling us from Volcano. Daniel, you there?
Yes, I am.
All right, we're having a really tough time hearing you. Make sure, please, that you turn down your radio and speak right into your phone.
Okay, can you hear me now?
That's better, thanks.
Okay, if I were the mayor, I would first do two things. I would teach, and I'd be quite willing to participate because I've had plenty of landlord-tenant cases myself. I manage a house at 173 Willick Avenue, and the police were at my house over 1,000 times, and it wasn't the building inspectors, it was the police problem. There were other problems, and you can't control the environment with so many private interests. And what I would do, first I would have the police represent the landlord-tenant code. So if there's a dispute, the police come. It's a matter of looking at the receipts and look at the agreement, look at the payment, making the determination. And as to when the eviction occurs, the police that are on spot, that has the reading skills that the average police officer has, will learn in a couple hours how to manage landlord-tenant code.
Okay, we're going to talk a little bit just about that. I mean, Mateo, he's saying that some of the problems might stem from a problem with landlord tenants, but how much of that is really part of the overall issue when you have someone who is tossed out? But that takes a while to be able to evict someone.
Yes, there is a process, and I'll admit I'm not an expert on landlord tenant issues here in Hawaii, but there is a process, and it takes a while. Normally, you have to give notice, you have to go to court, and you need a judgment to have someone kick someone out from their home. As I say, I'm not an expert. I'm not sure how much that contributes or not to homelessness. I do know that a lot of folks here in Hawaii rent. They don't own their own homes, and that we have one of the highest rents in the country. Talking about the jobs issue and wages, I know a number of homeless are working homeless, so they do have jobs. And Hawaii has the highest housing wage in the country. And what that means is that residents must earn $34 an hour to afford a two-bedroom unit. So it is not surprising that we have a number of working homeless.
And high turnover if they do find some place and be able to go, which kind of brings us back to another issue. Go ahead.
So I was going to respond that for those people who are homeless, unsheltered, who are working, and we do find many of them as well, some of them are living out of their cars too. We have programs in the service providers, among the service providers, that actually help people to get into housing, which I think is really what we want to do, as a final, solution for people. If they actually, are in that position, we're able to find or provide a deposit, first month's rent, sometimes even a gradual decrease in some monthly help for a couple months so that they can make that transition. So, the service providers are definitely trying to come up with some different solutions for different situations. And for those folks, we really do have some, resources to make that happen. But I think what we're really talking about are the people who chronically are on the sidewalk, in encampments. These are people, a lot of the time, who are not in that particular situation. And, we really do have to feel for a lot of the businesses that are dealing with that situation in the Kapalama area, Kalihi, even Iwale, where, our shelters are. We have encampments right across the street from our men's shelter. And a lot of that sprung up, largely because people felt like it was going to be okay to be there. And many people think that all of the people out there are our clients and guests, but in fact, they are not. So, we're dealing with it sort of as a business, because people are there. And what we've observed is that a lot of times the encampments are totally blocking the sidewalk, so people are not able to use them. They are causing people to have to walk into the roads. That causes danger. We see things like domestic violence going on, and then we also see, that there are assaults, even a stabbing recently, in that area. So it
just seems that, the points you're making is, first of all, that not everybody is employable. Not everybody's going to want to come out and be able to be fit for employment, even though there are jobs that are going wanting, that you've got so many different aspects to whether somebody becomes homeless or whether they can get out of homelessness. And for us to be able to continually remind ourselves how nuanced some of this really, truly is, and not try to look at it with a simplicity lens, because it just doesn't work. We saw earlier, in this last cycle with Aloha United Way and funds that they were disbursing that would get somebody, into a place. We've talked about Housing First for years now, the idea about getting somebody into a stable position so that then other services could be wrapped around. At least they would be maybe more predisposed to be able to access some of those services. We've seen some success with that in other places around the country. But now it looks like some of, you know, those funds may be threatened, looking at what's, you know, happening now in the state ledge. How concerned are you that we may backslide, that we may not see so many federal dollars coming in, we may not be able to even access, you know, private funds?
It's very concerning to me. And I think that the monies that were put toward the CSHI program that you described was a prevention program. You know, it's really to help people who are facing eviction. And it really did help a lot of people, evidently, because the statistics seem to show that. I think we have to remember that there's a continuum, and that if we don't address the folks who are becoming homeless, whether it's folks who are facing eviction or people coming out of jail and prison without much of a plan, a discharge plan, we are going to continue to see more people who are homeless. And many people who are being discharged from public safety feel like the street is just as good a place as any for them if they have nowhere to go.
So how does CITLI play into not making that continue and perpetuate itself?
I think for me, CITLI simply means that we're setting an expectation for behavior on the streets, you know, on the sidewalks. And it gives people, the police, a right to, you know, stop someone or to wake someone or to see if someone's okay, and to just really offer the services that are needed. I believe that Homeland Police Department, community policing, are all about supporting people. They're not about criminalizing people, and really trying to get them somewhere where they can get the help they need.
Mateo, from what you have seen, would you agree with Connie?
I agree in some respects. I would say our concerns with CITLI are that essentially you are criminalizing everyday conduct, as one of the callers said. You know, you're criminalizing sitting, lying down, sleeping, and that always raises constitutional concerns. You are also criminalizing a very specific population, or you're targeting a very specific population, the homeless, which is already marginalized or already very vulnerable. And again, that raises very serious issues, constitutional issues. And then finally, and this is the most important part, is that very often you leave people no option but to break the law. Because the fact of the matter is that if everyone that is homeless in Oahu showed up tonight to a homeless shelter, they would not be able to find shelter. They would not be able to find empty beds. There is about 10 for about last year, the point in time count counted about 2,100 homeless, unsheltered homeless. There is about 10% of empty beds for that. So about, you know, a little bit of around 200. So, you know, it is about resources. I don't think we have the resources, and for that reason, we have very serious concerns about CITLI, and it costs the city $750,000 to enforce CITLI every year.
And the point has been made: what if that money were shifted into other resources that would have people sheltered, and or would provide for more Housing First programs or similar type programs? We're going to take a few more callers now. If you want to join us, our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. But just a reminder, this is a rebroadcast of today's Town Square, and so phone calls will not be taken at the number given. Going now to Carl, calling us from the Big Island in Kapoho. Aloha.
Hello,
Carl.
Thank you for the wonderful show.
Pleasure.
Well, I just wanted to make a point that I really agree about. We don't have the resources, and I have lived over 20 years in a house that's 8 by 12 feet, and we could build this size houses if we could get the planning department to open up and create a new zoning called care area zoning, where all the construction rules that are ridiculous, like a snow load and three firemen, could be set aside, and we could build little houses like the one I have built with the same design. There's a bathroom, there's upstairs loft, there's a little stove, a little couch, and what the homeless people need is dignity. We all want to help someone, and they can't. They have no way to help each other. But if we give them a little 8-by-12-foot house with a common restroom and kitchen, then when they see another person on the ground for the first time in their life, they can say, hey, come sleep on my floor, man. And all of a sudden, they've helped someone.
All right, Carl. Thanks very much for the call. We've had other discussions about tiny homes before. There was one that was built that was just down at the Capitol. But moving that into a larger place, being able to say we're going to have not just container houses, as you know they have down at Sand Island, but to be able to do some of these tiny homes. Some of them are very attractive. They're cute. They're small. But they need a place. And they also need the infrastructure to be able to hold enough of them to create a village. And then you get the NIMBYism that sometimes plays into that, where people say, oh, that sounds great in the abstract, but I don't want that in my backyard. I don't want my kids seeing that.
Well, I think that people don't realize that a lot of these tiny homes are actually available to be those accessory dwelling units for regular lots, where I understand that a lot of people are accommodating relatives right now even. You know, so I think that we really are looking at that as definitely part of the answer, you know, like to have more of those alternative economically designed housing.
Our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And just a reminder, you're listening to a rebroadcast of Town Square, and calls will not be taken at the number given. Bill 13, if it passes the Honolulu City Council and gets to the mayor, would quite possibly extend Sitlai into parts of Iwale and Kalihi. Some businesses in Kalihi, as you've heard from Neil from Menahunemak, saying that, you know, they deal with a great deal of issues, from damage to the property to fear, and people who need to walk into their property to purchase product are afraid, all of that. What are we going to do about that? Is Sitlai the answer? Other municipalities around the country have dealt with issues similarly, even as recently as maybe 10 days ago in Fort Collins, Colorado. They are looking at it, but didn't go to the exact length that we have gone to in certain ways. Lots of places which are trying to grapple with this. How do you regard Sitlai in Hawaii? And just a reminder, you're listening to a rebroadcast of Town Square, and calls will not be taken at the number given. Going to Jane, calling us from Honolulu.
Hi, Bethann and esteemed panelists. I work in a business in Honolulu where we actually, it's actually kind of a gathering place where I work for homeless people. And unfortunately, I've also lived in another town where Sitlai was passed, which is Portland. And I see where the panelist who is sort of defending Sitlai is coming from. But at the end of the day, the police officers that come and take the woman who I believe has schizophrenia, who hangs outside of my business a lot, they take her to the police station. They don't take her to a doctor. What that woman needs is mental health care. She needs care, not discipline, not to be thrown in a cell alone. And I think it actually aggravates the problem at that point. I don't think it actually helps her. And it brings me back to this point that I think you guys were talking about earlier, which is that Sitlai is kind of dealing with a symptom of the problem. The problem is really, do we have good mental health care for people? Do we have good housing for people? And we're pretending like the problem is, well, the homeless people are just sitting on the ground and, you know, making our neighborhoods look unsafe, et cetera, attracting crime. But it doesn't seem to actually be solving issues at the local or national level at all.
Jane, before you ask your question, I just wanted to get some clarity from you. You say that you have a restaurant in Honolulu. Where in Honolulu? Are you downtown, Chinatown?
In Chinatown.
Okay. All right. So you're squarely seeing this in a very different way than if you had a restaurant in, say, Hawaii Kai.
Absolutely. I think, yeah, it's definitely a place where known to have a lot of homeless people congregate, but also,
so you had a question to ask?
Yes. I'm wondering, how can you defend Sitlai? This is going to the panelist who's, I suppose, is defending it more than the others. When, you know, we're actually seeing that as, like, helping private prisons or helping make money for prisons rather than, you know, diverting funds toward mental health care. Why isn't there a mental health care specialist going around with police officers at the very least?
Well, my understanding is that in some cases you do have mental health folks who are there down at the precinct when somebody is brought in, but not necessarily going around at the very same time as the police.
Well, I think, you know, what we've been doing is actually working more closely with the police. We actually do mental health services. We take a psychiatrist with us out on outreach. We also take people to the hospital. And the police also do what they call an MH, or, you know, an emergency transport to the ER when it's warranted. But it is based on, you know, people's behaviors, whether it's a danger to themselves or others. And I know I couldn't agree with you more. I wish that there was a more assertive way in some ways that we could deal with some of these situations. But there are cases where we are being able to take people to treatment and to be able to provide that. So I wouldn't want anyone to think that we're in favor of sit-lie as like a lone kind of solution. It is not. It is not. I agree totally that it's not a homeless solution. What I'm saying is that it does create the opportunity for us to offer services in a way that people might consider it more.
Her point, though, is that the bottom line seems to be that you see jail as being the revolving door for many people who have mental illness because there just isn't enough, you know, there aren't enough places for them to go. And even if you're able to get them into either Castle or into Queens at Kekela or to do something for them, that might be more long-lasting, that there seem to be more that are just right behind each and every one of them, particularly if they're just going in and out of jail.
And part of that is because our mental health laws here are such that they protect a person's rights so much that, in fact, someone who desperately needs treatment often does not access it.
You're talking about
it.
Involuntary yes. commitment.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we're going to take a few more calls. Unless Mateo, do you have anything to answer on any of this?
The only thing I wanted to add is that, you know, I agree with the caller that criminalization is probably going to take us nowhere, that jails should not be the de facto mental health facilities. And they are sometimes in our state. If you go to OCCC, a number of people suffer from addiction or mental health issues. And so to me, the question is, again, one of tools. And the criminal code is not a good tool to deal with a complex an issue as homelessness.
All right, we're going to go to another caller. If you want to join us, pick up the phone. Call us 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We're talking about sit-lie as we're now looking at a bill that may, in fact, expand what sit-lie's reach is able to do by going into Ivele or Kalihi, both of them, and how you feel about that. Going to, is it Mite? Or Mitai?
Yeah,
Mitai, are you there? Hi there, from Kaimuki.
Yes.
Go ahead.
The great conversation once again, and that the last caller that called in and talking with the restaurant, you know, that's such a big help, actually, for people on the street when the businesses don't see them strictly as a blight and keeping business away, but actually try to build a relationship so they know which people are there. Anyway, great conversation. And that's a tiny bit off subject, but not exactly. But nobody's talking about the other problem we have, which is people's homes. Like, we have so many homes in the state, especially large homes that the developers couldn't finish or are stuck on the market or whatever, especially in Hawaii Kai and down on the beach area. I don't expect these neighborhoods to accept homeless people in these vacant homes, but how do we value that as a society or as a community if we see no problem with tons of vacant homes, especially large ones, and people living on the street? They're criminals, but these vacant homes and these owners that live out of state that have no intention of doing anything with them any time, they have no responsibility for this issue.
Okay, well, you do bring up an issue that's more tangential than directly related to it, because people get to do what they want to do with their own private property as long as it doesn't fall into utter and total, you know, disrepair, and neighbors start to complain about all of that. But the greater philosophical issue that he's talking about, where we have so much wealth that's maybe concentrated in a certain few places around the state, and then we see so many homeless people that some folks just simply don't want to see or help, and you've got spaces there. Again, what do you do with that when it comes right down to how are we going to house people when we don't have enough places to house them? That seems to be the bottom line. Anybody want to add anything or put anything into that conversation?
I think that's really the bottom line, as you mentioned, Bethann, because if our civil society doesn't realize that everyone needs a place and needs a home and is not willing to work at kind of sharing the wealth, so to speak, then we will be left with this problem forever. You know, I think that it's really important that people, all of us, take responsibility, whether it's, you know, the person themselves or the person who has resources to share, whether it's, you know, our community in general, that we don't turn the other way and just say this problem doesn't exist. And I don't think anybody can really deny it anymore anyway.
Right, but you can certainly say that, well, oh, I'm just not going to do anything about it. There, surely mm-hmm. there will be somebody else who will. Mm-hmm. And what the big question has been for such a long time is, are we all willing to do something about this, however great or small, but to get buy-in from everyone to do something to move it forward in a meaningful way, because we're all on these little islands together. You know, it's not going to be as if someone's going to come along and magically make everything all better. That's all up to us. The question is, are you in for this? Are you going to buy into the idea that we have to do something? And how do you feel that CitLife fits into that or doesn't? 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Paul, calling us from Kaimuki. Got Kaimuki again. Paul, are you there? Welcome to Town Square.
Yes, I'm here. Hello.
Hi there.
I just thought I'd ask one specific question. There's a million more that I would like to ask. Stadium Park in Mo'ili'ili, I live in that area, and the restroom there, as far as every time I drive by it, it looks like there's been people living in it for years, and I'm not sure what this if it has anything to do with CitLife, but why cannot that park be cleaned up so outsiders can actually use the restroom when they go over to play baseball on their leagues on the weekend?
Well, that place has had some issues for a long time, off and on. Clearly, that's not necessarily within what would happen with Bill 13. But as you look at Stadium Park and Mo'ili'ili, that part of Honolulu, what's the situation there, Mateo?
So I'll admit, I'm not entirely sure what exactly the situation is on the ground. What I can say is that, you know, the ACLU, we agree that there should be equal access to public places, and that public places, people should feel safe and they should be clean. And so in that respect, we agree with the caller. And then the question again is what is the solution to that? And I hate to bring it back, but you have a fork in the road, criminalization on the one hand, and harm reduction and public health on the other.
I mean, I drive by that park too, and you see that there are people sometimes all over it, and it used to be a nice little place, and now not a lot of families want to go there and necessarily, you know, be there.
That park has actually turned into somewhat of a heroin park. You know, we have a lot of people there who are struggling with substance abuse, and we outreach there regularly. We offer services regularly. Part of it is, you know, just really asking someone, will you come with us to get an ID? You need an ID so we can get you housing. You know, we some of them will consider it for a moment, but then they don't want to leave. And ultimately, I think it comes down to a choice, you know, of whether they want to avail themselves of the services or not. But it doesn't mean that we stop trying. You know, we continue to offer the services, but if someone is resistant, then the question becomes, okay, if you continually resist the services, then are somehow the rights to do the things that you're doing going to be curtailed? You know, because a lot of the activity there is illegal activity, and the domestic violence there is very threatening and, you know, very intimidating as well.
I'm going to go now to Alan, calling us from Lihue. Aloha, Alan. Thank you for your patience. Welcome to Town Square. Alan? Okay, don't have Alan. Sorry about that. Moving on to Paul, another Paul, calling us from Honolulu. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi.
Hi there.
I just wanted to point out, you know, I catch these stories here and there, and I wanted to bring up and see what you guys had to say about, you know, in the 70s, 60s, and 70s, when I was a little kid, Sand Island was like a shanty town, right? Everybody, there's a bunch of people living down there. As a family, we'd go down there and go to the beach and play with the other kids. It was just like another neighborhood on the island, like going to Waimanawa and playing with the kids there, or Kailua. And then I remember, you know, when I think it was Fosse, you know, the big bulldozer of the houses out there. And then is this the same homeless problem that's just been rotating around the island since that place was changed into a gigantic park?
Well, I think, Connie, you've got a long view on this because you've been you've been in IHS for over 10 years, but you've got a lot more in your career beyond that, too. But it's not just the same population.
No, not by a long shot. I think, you know, people have to realize that there are so many contributing factors. One of the major things is what we've already talked about is the diminishing affordable housing. Secondly, you know, we have people who are coming back from war. We have veterans that are homeless. You know, this is the longest engagement, you know, that the U.S. has been involved in through our history, I believe. We also have people who are suffering mental illness that have become victims of a system that is disintegrating. You know, we had so many changes in our mental health system that really left some of the people homeless as well. And the laws then, you know, also don't allow them to access the services in such a way that we can do it very expediently. There's also the meth, the ICE epidemic that we've experienced over a long period of time. When I was a director of nursing at the Hawaii State Hospital, I, you know, had predicted back then, you know, some 20 years ago, that we would have a problem with people who might be homeless and have lost some of their cognitive abilities because of ICE. And I see it now. And it's not just their cognitive abilities, it's their physical health. ICE has just, you know, impacted them so dramatically that we really, sometimes that's the time when they're most vulnerable and they're willing to get some help. But that is another big part of it. And now we're also seeing a lot of people who are being priced out, seniors who are priced out of their housing. So many of these things are contributing to this growing, you know, problem that we have with homelessness. And I don't think people realize that there are so many factors involved, but there are. And we need to break it down to have some specific solutions for each of them. And I don't want to forget the last one that I wanted to mention was public safety, making sure that we don't incarcerate people for, you know, nonviolent crimes and for people to come out with a plan. You know, could we give them some housing and some, you know, some connections to resources, to employment, so that they don't go through this revolving door all the time? There are so many reasons why people are homeless, and I really hope that people really understand that we can't just group them together.
And I would ask all of you listening, do you really understand that fact, that we aren't talking about this as this great monolithic population called the homeless, but that there are so many subpopulations who are homeless for very different reasons and require such different remedies, or at least help to get to the remedy? Is that something that you carry with you when you see different people that you may encounter as you're walking along the street or in a park or driving by? 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. But just a reminder, this is a rebroadcast of today's Town Square, and so phone calls will not be taken at the number given. Neil, come back into the conversation a little bit with this, because, you know, when Connie and we've all talked about how different those populations may look, how do you characterize the population that you see in Kalihi? Are you talking about COFA families? Are you talking about people who are mentally ill? Are you talking about, you know, singles who, or families who are just, you know, kind of caught with dependencies of all types, alcohol, drugs, whatever it may be? Are you looking at all of that? Is there a sense that you have when you come out of your business?
In our situation, we have a specific group that's right on our property line, and the police have categorized these as the dangerous people. There's a camp farther down the same street who is totally segregated from the camp that's on the side of my building, and we've been told by the people, and the business owners do engage with the homeless guys. It's not like, you know, we don't want to talk to them. They're people, and some of them are very nice people too. I've talked to quite a few, but the one that's just on my building has been described as a dangerous type. The rest of the homeless distance themselves from the people on the side of my building. There was an active drug bust, you know, on the street last week. They closed the entire street. It was right there on that little section where they're adjacent to my building.
Which makes it awfully difficult for you.
Yeah,
I
may have an extreme case, but I have a concentration of what I would call probable illicit activity. To the point where, yeah, I wouldn't walk out there at night. I would not. It's dangerous. It's literally dangerous. And I'm a Kalihi guy. I kind of know what the street feels like. I went to San.
But this scares you.
You can recognize a situation that is not good.
Okay, yeah. We're gonna move on and get Jody in from Eva Beach. Aloha, Jody. Welcome to Town Square.
Thank you. I'm calling because I really believe that the court system needs to change the definition of harm to self or others. There are so many people out there that could go into the psychiatric hospitals or go into treatment, but there's such a narrow definition by the court system, harm to self or others. I'm a psychiatric RN, and it's very hard to watch all these people that could be in treatment or in the hospital if we had a different definition, because I agree that they can have a drug bust, but that's not helping the people that are on a lot of drugs. They need to go get them and get them help and open up the definition.
Jody, you bring up a really good point, and we've had others who are involved with mental health in the state at a pretty high level say, you know, it's a real shame that we have to get to a point where they have to slip over and be, you know, they have committed something that's so egregious that then there's no way of saying that it can't possibly be exactly what it is. And so the idea of harm to self, harm to others, and that goes back to the whole idea of whose rights are we going to carry, whose rights are going to be somewhat trumped by a societal need to see that someone is put into a place where they might get help or perhaps not.
And Jody, this is Connie. I totally agree with you. I'm a psychiatric clinical nurse specialist myself, and I really believe that the laws do need to change, and there are efforts being made to change them. I think this legislative session, there was a bill introduced, you know, to talk about a psychiatric review board that could make decisions for treatment instead of having to always go to court, because I think that it is a clinical decision, in my opinion anyway, that should be made when people need the treatment. And treatments are not like the way that they used to be, where, you know, they're more targeted now. There aren't the side effects that, you know, that we used to have before with other treatments, and it's just so much more humane. So I do think that that plays a big part in terms of solving our chronic homeless problem. But again, that's just one segment of our population that we're dealing with.
And also to be aware that actually finding the appropriate treatment for someone can take time and trial and error, because certain drugs that may work on one person may not at all work on someone else. They may cause more depression, more anxiety, more fearfulness, all kinds of things. There's a reason why there are warnings and there are side effects. And so there isn't a simple silver bullet that's going to make it better for everyone. That's going to take some time, too. And we're not good with waiting for things or having to move through trial and error. It's something that we want to have more immediately fixed. 941-3689 is our number, or 877-941-3689. Going to Shannon calling us from Hilo. Aloha, Shannon. I was waiting for somebody to ask about this question. I guess you're going to be it, about Senator Josh Green and his bill that would treat homelessness as a medical condition.
Yes. Hi. Aloha. Thanks for having me. Yes. So my name is Shannon Mattson, and I'm calling from Hilo, and that is definitely my question for the panelists, is what they think of that that proposal, the bill by Senator Josh Green. And then I also just had a comment, and this is just, it's a personal thing, but I see it as you guys have all mentioned, it's a varied issue. This is a huge issue, and the population is very dynamic and diverse. And from the work I've done with the houseless population, I found that most of them prefer to be referred to as houseless, especially in regards to the Native Hawaiian population, because they don't see themselves as homeless. In fact, for some of them, this is the only home they've ever known, and just because they don't have a house as defined by those of us who do live indoors.
Okay, Shannon, forgive me for cutting you off, but I want to get to your greater point about the Medicaid issues and what might be constituted as a health condition as homelessness, just because we're running short of time. But we hear you about houselessness and the difference between carrying your home with you inside your heart and simply not having a house in which you may reside. So thanks very much for that. The idea that, you know, Josh Green put forth got a lot of attention, not just in Hawaii, but across the nation and in other places, too, around the world where the story was picked up. How do you feel about homelessness as being regarded as a health condition and being able then to have Medicaid dollars to in some way treat it, remedy it, or help with it?
I think when I spoke with Senator Green, he was really referring to those people who are chronically homeless and really costing the service, the system, the healthcare system, tons of money. And I think if he, as an emergency room physician, sees people over and over and sees that it's not working and realizes, hey, some of these people really need to have a home in order to begin the process of recovery from their homelessness or the mental health issues or the substance abuse, then, you know, I think we need to really look at that, because we need to be a little bit more creative maybe about, you know, using our Medicaid dollars in a way that would actually be a solution, you know, rather than just doing the same old thing and not working.
And potentially saving money.
Yes.
Because the person isn't going in and out and in and
yes.
out of the ER and costing us, because we're taxpayers, the money to be able to do that. It's an interesting concept, and we're watching how it's moving through
and
this
that,
time.
That said, you know, it's a slippery slope, because you don't want to just say, oh, homelessness will get you a home, you know, and a diagnosis just purely being homeless, because it then would attract more people to think, oh, if I'm homeless, maybe I'll be able to avail myself.
Yeah, that goes back to the criterion and how that,
right.
that would be regarded right. once that moves through. But an idea of how we look at this a little differently than we've looked at it in past. We've got a couple minutes left in the program, and I want to talk to all three of you about what you've, you know, heard from other people. Clearly not looking at just sit lie. I mean, most of our callers didn't directly address sit lie. They're more looking at this from a larger perspective and looking at those root causes that seem to be so difficult for us to wrap our arms around, particularly when it comes to affordable housing. You made the point, Neil, about employment, so that employment might not be there. But even if someone is employed, can they really afford to be in a home? Mateo, you mentioned earlier somebody has to make about $34 an hour to be able to afford an average home here. And we know that's not going to happen. So just going right around the table once again, as you look at it now, is there something, even in a smaller way, that you think we should be doing that isn't happening now, whether you're seeing it happen at a legislative level, if you're in a neighborhood, but something that might mitigate this or move this forward in a way that we haven't seen up until this very date? Connie, anything that you can see as you look out and you see IHS and your position with this, regardless of sit lie, but looking at this from maybe a more holistic perspective?
I think from my perspective, it really requires a lot more collaboration, you know, between different entities. We're actually helping to sponsor a faith summit on homelessness later this month, and it's really about bringing the faith community into the picture also. But I think if we need to bring the resources together, not deduplicate or not duplicate the services that service providers are doing, use our money more wisely, and affordable housing all the way.
Well, and you talk about bringing resources together, but and some things that we haven't talked about in terms of that thwart that, but at least to be able to address that with different communities all participating. Looking at the business community, Neil, what do you want to see from the business community? And you got about 30 seconds.
It's been very interesting to listen to all of this today, but I think a lot of us business people have seen from the beginning, this is a very comprehensive, broad-ranging problem. It's not one of anything. It's economic. There's an economic base to this thing. There's a legal base to it. There's a moral base to this thing. And you've got to get all these things working together to find a final solution. The sit lie law is a tool that's being used because it's the only tool available. And that's kind of how it's being used at this point, right?
And so, Mateo, you want to have the final word?
Sure. So one program that I think everyone should look into is Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion Program, which essentially allows the police to refer someone to a social worker, and that way they can get the help they need as opposed to going to jail.
Even if it's only a couple hours a month, it's better than nothing.
Yeah, and the idea again is that it gives you another tool that is not incarceration.
Lots more tools, lots more working together, and perhaps a broader coalition. Thank you so much to Neil Arakaki from Menahuni Mac, Connie Mitchell from IHS, I'm Mateo Caballero from the ACLU, and you for joining us for Town Square. I'll see you tomorrow morning for the conversation, and next week we'll be back. Take good care of yourselves. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Aloha.